The screen opens up, revealing static. The static transforms into the text, HBO. HBO documentary films. In a brick warehouse, Jonathan Majors lifts his head with somber eyes. Wearing a blue hoodie, his gaze shifts as he stands with his hands on his hips. He breathes in and pauses, looking us in the eye.
I have no love for America. As such, I have no patriotism. I have no country. What country have I? The institutions of this country do not know me, do not recognize me as a man. I am not thought of or spoken of except as a piece of property.
Jonathan stares off for a moment.
Now, in such a country as this, I cannot have patriotism.
Words appear on a black background. Frederick Douglass, New York City, May 1847.
Imagine that you had to dispel doubts about your full humanity every time you took to a stage.
Henry Louis Gates, Jr.
Imagine you had to refute doubts about your own native ability every time you picked up a pen.
A stoic Frederick Douglass.
Imagine having to fight to show that you were as complicated a human being as any who walked the face of the earth. Having to fight that battle over and over every day. That was the life of Frederick Douglass. He was the most famous black man in the world in the 19th century, and he achieved that position through one means, his voice.
A graphic shows a line of black people tethered by a chain, followed by various historical black figures. HBO Documentary Films presents a McGee Media and Inkwell Media production, inspired by the book Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David Blight, produced by Aloishan Babalola, edited by Derek Ambrosi. The title appears next to a colored portrait of Douglass. Frederick Douglass in five speeches. Executive producer, Henry Louis Gates Jr., directed by Julia Marchesi. Text on a black background reads, Part 1. I have come to tell you something about slavery. In a dimly lit auditorium, Andre Holland wears a fitted suit as he sits in front of a studio microphone. He places the book of Douglass autobiographies on a podium, then opens it to a bookmarked page. Words appear on a black background. The autobiographies of Frederick Douglass, read by Andre Holland.
More than 20 years of my life were consumed in a state of slavery. I grew up to manhood, eating the bread and drinking the cup of slavery with the most degraded of my brother bondmen, and sharing with them all the painful conditions of their wretched lot. In consideration of these facts, I feel that I have a right to speak and to speak strongly. Yet, my friends, I feel bound to speak truly.
Kedrick Roy, historian.
The power of Douglass's words, the way that he wielded language, was undeniable and is still undeniable.
He could take you in a single sentence sometimes inside of a crisis and say, here's what it's doing to us. Here's what it's doing to you. Here's what it's doing to the nation.
There can be no peace to the wicked while slavery continues in the land. It will be condemned, and there will be agitation.
He was able to realize from his own experience that an arbitrary system had been created, designed to reinforce the sense of inferiority of every black person. A system that was designed to make them believe that nature had made them inferior to white people. And his job was to blow up that system.
Text appears over a sepia-toned bay. Frederick Douglass is born into slavery in Maryland around 1818. He spends his early years on a large plantation near the Chesapeake Bay. Andre continues reading.
The very first mental effort that I now remember on my part was an attempt to solve the mystery. Why am I a slave?
A field of corn wavers in a breeze.
Why are some people slaves and others masters? I could not have been more than 7 or 8 years old when I began to make this subject my study.
David Blight.
It's a childhood where he has to learn to survive. He has to learn to overcome his own fear. He has to see brutality but live past it.
A drawing shows a white man lashing a slave.
From my earliest recollection, I entertained a deep conviction that slavery would not always be able to hold me within its foul embrace. The desire for freedom only needed a favorable breeze to fan it into a blaze at any moment.
Kenneth Morris Jr., Douglas's descendant.
There was one point in his life that he described as divine providence in his favor, and that was he was chosen from among all of the children on the plantation on the eastern shore of Maryland to go to Baltimore to be the house servant for his master's family.
I left that plantation with inexpressible joy. Going to live at Baltimore opened the gateway to all my subsequent prosperity.
A boy at the harbor.
Baltimore made it possible for Douglas to dream and imagine. He sees the world come into the harbor of Baltimore, this maritime capital, and he can begin to imagine that there's a world outside.
But what happened most importantly when he got there, his slave mistress didn't know that it was illegal to teach him. She was just a kind Christian lady with his heart. And there was Fred, you know, bright and eager and ready to learn. And so she naturally began to teach him his ABCs.
He's in search of any kind of adult loving figure he can find. He finds one in Sophia Auld. She taught him his alphabet, read out loud with him, got him interested in language.
But alas, this kind heart had but such a short time to remain such. Mr. Auld found out what was going on and at once forbade Mrs. Auld to instruct me further, telling her that it was unlawful as well as unsafe to teach a slave to read. He would at once become unmanageable and of no value to his master. These words sank deep into my heart and called into existence an entirely new train of thought. From that moment, I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom.
Kenneth Morris Jr.
And he would teach himself to read and write. He was very clever in the way that he went about doing that. He would carry bread in his pocket, and he would trade the bread for reading lessons with the poor kids.
He picks up scraps of the King James Version of the Bible from gutters. He dries them out, and he sets them out nicely so he can learn from them.
He was reading all the time. And the fact that he never had one day of formal education is just flabbergasting.
He tells us that he first sees the word abolition in a newspaper and then again in a magazine. We can only imagine our way into a young boy's mind. He's trapped in this world of enslavement. And now he learns that up north they're organizing to end slavery. That's got to be an amazing source of hope. And by the time he's 18, he's scheming to escape.
Text appears over a drawing of a railroad. In the fall of 1838, Douglas sets into motion a carefully laid plan. Dressed in a sailor's uniform and holding the identification papers of a free man, he jumps on a moving train at the Baltimore station.
On Monday, the third day of September 1838, I bade farewell to the city of Baltimore and to that slavery which had been my abhorrence from childhood.
This is one of the most unusual escape stories in all of the literature about slavery. There are no bloodhounds, and no knights hiding in the swamps. Essentially, Douglas goes to the Baltimore train station and jumps on a train.
I was well on the way to Havre de Grace before the conductor came into the Negro car to collect tickets and examine the papers of his black passengers. This was a critical moment in the drama. Had the conductor looked closely at the paper, he could not have failed to discover that it called for a very different looking person from myself. The train was moving at a very high rate of speed for that time of railroad travel, but to my anxious mind, it was moving far too slowly. Minutes were hours, and hours were days.
He takes that train, two other trains, and three steamboats later, in about 38 hours, He arrived into Lower Manhattan at the base of Chambers Street.
A vibrant cityscape.
I found myself in the big city of New York, a free man.
Douglas in a suit.
The bonds that had held me to old master were broken. No man now had a right to call me his slave or assert mastery over me. Such is briefly the manner of my escape from slavery and the end of my experience as a slave.
Text reads, Douglas settles in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where he begins to seek out abolitionists and attend their meetings.
In the summer of 1841, a grand anti-slavery convention was held in Nantucket under the auspices of William Lloyd Garrison and his friends.
William Lloyd Garrison was the most important abolitionist in America at the time Douglas met him. He led a moral suasionist campaign to destroy slavery.
In an auditorium.
I attended this convention, never supposing I would take part in the proceedings. I was not aware that anyone connected with the convention even so much as knew my name. I was, however, quite mistaken.
He says he didn't intend on speaking at the convention. He was just there to listen.
But once asked to speak, he got up and simply told his personal story from his slave youth.
Text appears on a black background. I have come to tell you something about slavery. 1841, performed by Denzel Whitaker. In a warehouse, Denzel stands wearing a colorful beaded necklace. He lifts his head and purses his lips.
I feel greatly embarrassed when I attempt to address an audience of white people. I'm not used to speaking to them. And it makes me tremble when doing so, because I have always looked up to them with fear. My friends, I've come to tell you something about slavery. What I know of it, as I've felt it.
Denzel stares ahead steadily, then lowers his eyes.
When I came north, I was astonished to find that the abolitionists, they knew so much about it. They were acquainted with its deadly effects as well as if they had lived within its midst. But although they can tell you its history, though they can depict its horrors, they cannot speak as I can from experience. They cannot refer you to a back covered with scars as I can. For I have felt these wounds. I have suffered under the lash without the power of resisting. Yes, my blood has sprung out as the lash embedded itself within my flesh.
Denzel scowls, then tilts his head with a wry smile.
Yet my master has the reputation of being a pious man and a good Christian. I'm not from any of the states where slaves are said to be in their most degraded condition, but from Maryland, where slavery is said to exist within its mildest form. Yet I can stand here and relate atrocities that would make your blood boil at the thought of them. I lived on the plantation of Colonel Lloyd on the eastern shore of Maryland and belonged to the gentleman's clerk. He owned probably not less than 1,000 slaves. And I mention the name of the man and also the persons who perpetrated the deeds of which I am about to relate, running the risk of being hurled back into interminable bondage, for yet I am a slave. Yet for the sake of the cause, of the sake of humanity, I will mention the names and glory in running the risk of it. For I have the gratification to know that if I shall fall by the utterance of the truth in this matter, that if I shall be hurled back into bondage to gratify my slaveholder to be killed by inches, that every drop of blood I shall shed, every groan which I shall utter, every pain which shall rack my frame, every sob which I shall indulge, shall be the instrument under God of tearing down the bloody pillar of slavery and of hastening the day of deliverance for 3 millions of my brethren in bondage.
Denzel's glowering stare fades into a black and white portrait of a sullen Frederick Douglass. Later, Denzel sits in the warehouse.
What's interesting is I feel like there's been individuals over time who have had to do great things at a much younger age. In his early 20s, having to deliver this, again, in front of a body of white people must have been, like, terrifying. But at the same time, too, like, he's already suffered so much terror, what more does he have to lose? You could feel his passion. You could feel it within the words. You don't even have to see it. It was just like his soul transcended. It was like something entered his body and then just like he was channeling through.
It was so compelling, however, this personal story, this personal witness, that they invited him to speak again the next morning.
And with that, a phenomenon was born.
Words appear on a black background. Part 2, I Have No Love for America. In stop motion animation, Douglas gestures to a crowd.
Once William Lloyd Garrison hears Douglas deliver his address in Nantucket, he is enraptured with Douglas's abilities and his skills and his gifts.
The Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society hired him to go out on the circuit that fall.
Much interest was awakened. Many came, no doubt, from curiosity to hear what a Negro could say in his own cause. Fugitive slaves were rare then, and as a fugitive slave lecturer, I had the advantage of being a brand new fact. The first one out.
Audiences loved this. He had a gift as a storyteller, that he had an unforgettable voice.
What Douglas has that no white abolitionist had was the ability to tell his story from the perspective of an enslaved person. And because of that authenticity and because of the skills that he developed to communicate that authenticity, the sky was the limit for Douglas's ambitions and aims.
He wanted to defeat slavery, but I think he also has that young man's ambition to defeat those around him who were doing the same thing he was, and he just wanted to do it better than they did.
Tell your story, Frederick, would whisper my revered friend, Mr. Garrison, as I stepped upon the platform. I could not always follow the injunction, for I was now reading and thinking. New views of the subject were being presented to my mind. It did not entirely satisfy me to narrate wrongs. I felt like denouncing them.
He's beginning to kind of burst out of the strategic straitjacket that the Garrisonians had put him in.
The Garrisonians wanted to control the sound of Frederick Douglass's voice. Just stick to the facts, Fred. You know, you're speaking kind of white, Fred. Put a little plantation in your voice, Fred. Nobody's going to believe that anyone who sounds as white or as educated as you was really an enslaved person. So remember your role, boy. And he goes, remember my role, huh? I'll show you.
Text reads, as a fugitive from slavery in the North for 7 years, Douglas publishes his first autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. Sarah Lewis, art historian.
Without question, Frederick Douglass wrote himself into history with his autobiography.
His book is not only a testimony about the experience of a sensitive enslaved person, it is an act of language. Douglass creates a work of art.
The publishing of my narrative was regarded by my friends with mingled feelings of satisfaction and apprehension. I became myself painfully alive to the liability which surrounded me. It was thus I was led to seek a refuge in England.
When Frederick Douglass had to escape to Europe, he was a fugitive slave at the time, and the notoriety of having a best-selling book threatened his freedom. So he would flee to Europe for a couple of years as a cooling-off period and speak about the abolition of slavery.
He spoke in some hundred and some venues all over the British Isles.
The red carpet is essentially rolled out for him, and he begins to realize, in England, I'm treated with respect and with dignity, but in America, I'm treated as property.
And he could, for the first time, as he says, feel like a man, by which he meant a human being, and not a black man, not a black human being. And that, everybody, I experienced that. I experienced that the first time I went to Europe, and certainly the first time I went to Africa. And that is a deeply affecting experience.
When Douglass returned from England in the spring of 1847, he returns both an inspired young man, but he also returns extremely angry. This is a much more militant Douglass as an abolitionist. And when he returns, he goes out on the circuit immediately, speech making. But in those speeches, he starts with lines like, my country hates me, I hate it back.
He was young, he was outraged, He was powerful, and he wasn't going to take it anymore. He was just all fire.
A portrait of Douglas shows his piercing stare. Text appears on a black background, Country, Conscience, and the Anti-Slavery Cause, 1847, performed by Jonathan Majors. He stares off for a moment.
I have no love for America. As such, I have no patriotism.
Jonathan creases his brow.
The only thing that links me to this land is my family. And the painful consciousness that here there are 3 million of my fellow creatures groaning beneath the iron rod of the worst despotism that could be devised even in pandemonium, that here are men and brethren identified with me by their complexion, identified with me by their hatred of slavery, identified with me by their love and aspirations for liberty. Identify with me by the stripes upon their backs, their inhumane wrongs and cruel sufferings. This, and this only, attaches me to this land and brings me here to plead with you and with the country at large for the disenthrallment of my oppressed countrymen and to overthrow this system of slavery which is crushing them to the earth.
Jonathan regains his composure and lowers his eyes.
But it is asked, what good will this do, or what good has it done? Have you not irritated, have you not annoyed your American friends and the American people rather than done them good? I admit we have irritated them. They deserve to be irritated. I am anxious to irritate the American people on this question. As it is in physics, so in morals, there are cases which demand irritation and counter-irritation. The conscience of the American public needs this irritation. And I would blister it all over from center to circumference until it gives signs of a purer and a better life than it is now manifesting to the world.
Frederick bears a determined look in a photo.
This was the speech in which we were closest in age. Frederick is 30 years old in this moment. And I'm 31 years old in this moment.
When he says that it's crushing them to the earth, that's when I went, okay, well, that's Brother Floyd. You know, that is that image. And it's not a new thing. Just made me want to say those words to people. For the people who couldn't.
Frown lines define Frederick's brow.
He was so angry. So you can begin to see it right there. Now he's going to plow this new energy, of course, into a newspaper. He wants to create his own kind of anti-slavery movement apart from the Garrisonians.
Nothing more dramatic could have recalculated their relationship than for Douglas to establish a parallel publication.
Garrisonians will be extremely angry about this.
It's as if he thought about it while he was in England. How can I declare my independence? How can I show I'm a man?
And now the fame grows ever, ever, ever more.
Douglas is stone-faced with a goatee.
As the fame grows, the invitations to speak grow. It became a kind of an American phenomenon to see Douglas. Did you see Douglas? Let me tell you the time I first saw Douglas. I first heard Douglas. Oh, what did he sound like? Newspapers are full of this.
This was, as many journalists had put it, a volcanic magisterial orator. He could command crowds of thousands.
A massive crowd in a garden.
And from that point on, all the way to 1877, he will never make a living any other way than with his voice and his pen.
Words appear on a black background. Part 3, We Need the Storm. A black and white portrait shows Douglas with a horseshoe mustache.
He wrote millions of words. But Douglas will not tell us anything about his private life, especially his marriage. He hid everything he could about his marriages, relationships, his children.
His relationship with Anna Douglas is an enigma, a puzzle. And I think he wanted it that way.
Frederick Douglass had a wife? What? Why don't we know anything about her? Who was she? Who would be married to Frederick Douglass?
A photo of his wife.
While he was traveling around the world speaking out against slavery, you know, she would take care of the kids, she would take care of the finances, she would press his clothes so that he would be looking sharp.
She met Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, John Brown. Anybody who was anybody in the anti-slavery movement came to her house, but she tended to stay in the kitchen area or out in the garden or, you know, in spaces where she was comfortable.
His marriage to Anna is both the center of his life, the heart of his family, but it also became increasingly, no doubt, what we moderns would call a difficult marriage. There's one letter he writes to a friend, a woman friend, he has lots of women correspondents. And he just unloads about how Anna has just read the riot act to him.
A letter.
If I should write down all her complaints, there would be no room to put my name at the bottom. And by the time I am home a week or two longer, I shall have pretty full learned in how many points there are needs of improvement in my temper and disposition as a husband and a father.
They were married 44 years, and I was angry at him after seeing the extent to which Frederick Douglass ignored her and her contributions to his life in his writing. But you don't do the kinds of things that Frederick Douglass did without some substantial ego going on. As to the whole question of fidelity, I can only say that it's much disputed.
Too many times, scholars, both black and white, have felt it necessary to remove the warts from prominent figures in African American history. Douglass had his flaws, he had his weaknesses. I think the more human we make our heroes, the more noble they become.
An Ambrotype of Douglass.
Well, there's always a poignant contrast between Douglass's private and public lives. That same virile Douglass that we have a visual image of also collapsed into depression, collapsed into almost incapacity at times under the pressure.
Andre narrates.
The demand upon my time and attention by my books and papers and by visitors are incessant. I am beginning to look upon a journey as a potential misfortune.
A photo of Douglass in profile with a heavy brow.
In the early 1850s, it's clear to me he had what we would sometimes call a nervous breakdown. He kind of fell to pieces. But even in this moment, 51, 52, 53, 54, he does some of his greatest work.
In the summer of 1852, when he was 34 years old, Douglass wrote what's probably his most famous speech.
He was invited to speak at the Ladies' Anti-Slavery Society about Independence Day.
Big event. Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York. Douglass says, okay, I'll give a 4th of July speech, but I'm gonna speak beyond Corinthian Hall, I'm gonna speak beyond Rochester, I'm gonna speak to the country. He worked on that speech for at least 3 weeks. He tells us that in a letter, and man, does it show it.
It would go down in history as the oratorical masterpiece of the entire abolitionist movement.
Text appears on a black background. What to the Slave is the 4th of July, 1852, performed by Nicole Beharie. Nicole nods as she peers at the imagined audience, her long braids draped over her shoulder, with a slack jaw. Her gaze shifts about the space.
Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, he who could address this audience without a quailing sensation has stronger nerves than I have. I do not remember ever to have appeared as a speaker before an assembly more shrinkingly, nor with greater distrust of my ability than I do this day. The papers and placards say that I am to deliver a 4th of July oration. Fact is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable. And the difficulties to be overcome in getting from the latter to the former are by no means slight.
I liken the speech to a symphony with 3 movements. The first movement, fairly short, is Douglas putting his audience at ease about the glories of the Founding Fathers, the glories of the Declaration of Independence, and it's beautiful. And the audience must have felt like, wow, Frederick's gonna lift us up today.
Fellow citizens, I am not wanting in respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men. They were peace men. But they preferred revolution to peaceful submission to bondage.
And then the whole middle movement of the symphony is like a hailstorm. It's the physical horror of slavery he wrecks upon his audience. You invited me here to sing for you, but I'm not gonna sing. I'm gonna make you hurt.
Mark the sad procession as it moves wearily along and the inhuman wretch who drives them. Hear his savage yells and his blood-chilling oaths as he hurries on his affrighted captives. Attend the auction. See the men examined like horses. See the forms of women rudely and brutally exposed to the shocking gaze of American slave buyers.
Nicole stares ahead with intensity.
Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak here today? What do I or those I represent have to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and natural justice embodied in that declaration extended to us?
Nicole bears a pained expression.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July?
She wipes a tear away.
I answer a day that reveals to him more than any other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mock. The existence of slavery in this country brands your humanity as base pretense and your Christianity as a lie.
Nicole opens her mouth to speak, but stops.
Had I the ability and could I reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
And he stops. You can sense a pause in the rhetoric. It's as though the storm is over. The audience has felt in pain for 10 pages of this text. And then he lets him back up. The last short movement of the speech, he says, but your nation is still young, it is still malleable, but you're on the precipice of self-destruction. If you can't solve this problem of slavery, there will be no America.
I do not despair of this country. There are forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of slavery. I therefore leave off where I began. With hope.
Nicole's wistful expression fades into a portrait of Douglas with a stolid gaze. Later, Nicole sits in the warehouse.
We don't hear a lot about people who weren't allowed to have an education and who got this far, had such, you know, eloquent language and such an intention. You know, he's a black man in that period, or even in this period. He has to be extremely savvy about getting people's attention and disarming people and then figuring out how to get in there to really change people's thinking. And he does it really effectively and beautifully.
Douglas knew that an argument had to be eloquent to be persuasive, that you had to appeal to the mind, but through the emotions. And he knocked it out of the park.
Words appear on a black background. Part 4, They Will Fight with Vengeance. A photograph shows the military in a field of cannons and weaponry.
The Civil War began when Douglas was 43 years old. So he was too old to fight, but he wasn't too old to deliver his speeches and his writings to the American people who he felt needed to hear it.
An older Douglas.
The war brings about a personal recreation and transformation. Douglas saw it as finally, the coming of what he had most hoped for.
During all the winter of 1860, notes of preparation for a tremendous conflict came to us on every wind.
A barren, snowy field.
The South was mad and would listen to no concessions. They had come to hate everything which had the prefix free. Free states, free schools, free speech, and freedom generally. And they would have no more such prefixes. This haughty and unreasonable attitude of the imperious South saved the slave and saved the nation. From the first, I, for one, saw this war as the end of slavery.
A dove sits in a black person's hands.
In the first year or two of the war, he's still very much an outsider. He's on the circuit speaking, but he's just writing in his newspaper month after month after month, especially criticisms of the Lincoln administration. He's trying to light fires under Republicans, but he has no access to them. He's not an insider at all.
Text reads, President Lincoln signs the Emancipation Proclamation. It declares that all persons held as slaves in the rebellious states are and henceforth shall be free.
The 1st of January, 1863 was a memorable day in the progress of American liberty and civilization. This proclamation changed everything.
Abraham Lincoln issues the Emancipation Proclamation in part to allow African Americans to join the Union cause. They couldn't up until then.
Not only did it change the nature of the war, but it gave black men, for the first time, the legal right to kill white men.
The corpse of a white soldier.
And then he did what Douglas always did. He went to his desk, he wrote a new speech. In that speech, he famously says, "This proclamation has the opportunity now to free us all from the past."
Words appear on a black background. The Proclamation and a Negro Army, 1863, performed by Coleman Domingo. Wearing a black suit and gold-faced watch, Coleman clasps his hands.
There are certain great national acts, which by their relation to universal principles, properly belong to the whole human family. In Abraham Lincoln's proclamation of the 1st of January, 1863, is one of these acts. But I hold that the proclamation, good as it is, will be worthless, a miserable mockery, unless the nation shall so far conquer its prejudice as to welcome into the army full-grown black men to help fight the battles of the Republic. That paper proclamation must now be made iron, lead, and fire by the prompt employment of the Negro's arm in this contest. I know it is said that Negroes won't fight, but I distrust the accuser. I know the colored men of the North. I know the colored men of the South. They are ready to rally under the stars and stripes at the first tap of the drum. Give them a chance. Stop calling them niggers and call them soldiers. Stop telling them they can't fight and tell them they can fight and shall fight and they will fight and fight with vengeance. Give them a chance. Away with prejudice, away with folly. And in this death struggle for liberty, country, and permanent security, let the black iron hand of the colored man fall heavily on the head of the slaveholding traitors and rebels and lay them low. Give them a chance. Give them a chance. I don't say they are great fighters. I don't say they will fight better than other men. All I say is, give them a chance.
A photograph of Douglas by J.P. Ball.
The moment you read Frederick Douglass's words, you think that they were written yesterday. Literally, especially dealing with all the upheaval that we have in our country. A lot of people don't know a lot about him, but I mean, that's just American history, period. You know, we don't know a lot about ourselves. That's also the trick of this country, to try to make us forget and have amnesia. So I think the more that we put Frederick Douglass's words on stage now, as we interrogate the soul of America, the better for all of us. I love the attack that he has with it, because he's so intelligent and strong. You can't deny whatever he's saying. It's very spirited, and he's trying to really get people going and move the crowd to think.
Frederick Douglass sees black soldiers wielding rifles as one of the clearest and most profound expressions of American citizenship. He begins to transition from America being about you and yours to America being about we and ours.
Douglass believed that if black men comported themselves nobly and heroically, demonstrating bravery on the battlefield, then certainly Americans would say, you deserve all the rights inscribed in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. Unfortunately, he was wrong.
Black men stand as white soldiers sit.
I had assured colored men that once in the Union Army, they would be put on an equal footing with other soldiers, that they would be paid, promoted, and exchanged as prisoners of war. But the government had not kept its promise, or the promise I made for it. I was induced to go to Washington and lay the complaints of my people before President Lincoln. I was an ex-slave, identified with a despised race, and yet, I was to meet the most exalted person in this great republic.
A photo of Lincoln by Alexander Gardner.
He goes to Washington in August 1863 with no appointment. He just goes and gets in line at the White House, says, I want to speak to the president, and Lincoln lets him in.
I shall never forget my first interview with this great man. There was no vain pomp or ceremony about him. I at once felt myself in the presence of an honest man. Proceeding to tell him who I was and what I was doing, he promptly but kindly stopped me, saying, I know who you are, Mr. Douglass.
Without a doubt, Abraham Lincoln matured in his ideas about black people, who and what a black person was. And there's no doubt that Douglass played a key role in that transition.
When Douglass meets Lincoln in the White House, it's a bridge. It's a first step for Douglass to begin to enter into higher orders and levels of power.
Now he has a role. He has the role of being recognized by the President of the United States as the spokesman of black America.
He is, as he loved to say himself, the representative colored man in the United States. I think Douglass thought that he single-handedly was charged with the task of refuting every racist stereotype about black people. But also, his ego was healthy enough and big enough that he thought he was up to the task.
And that's, of course, where the photography comes in.
An ambrotype of a seasoned Douglass.
He is one of the most, if not the most, photographed American in the 19th century. He was profoundly insightful about the potential uses of photography to refute stereotypes, the caricatures about black people.
These photos were taken so that people could see this intelligent, learned black man as an equal. He's not casting his eyes down as slaves were told to. He's looking you directly in your eyes, so that's a challenge and a provocation in itself.
A portrait of Douglass with a defiant stare.
It's important to understand when thinking about Frederick Douglass that there is no model for who he is at this period of time in American life. None. He has to invent himself effectively. He has to will himself to be seen in a way that no one in society was ready to see a black man. There's one image that I love that shows Douglass as a homeowner with his children across the two brownstones, townhomes that he owned in Washington, D.C. They're defying every possible convention about what it means to be a black family and a black man in American life.
He was really an A-list celebrity, what we would call an A-list celebrity today.
especially after he appeared on the cover of Harper's in the 1870s. Once you're on the cover of Harper's, that was like Time Magazine and Google put together back then. But being such a national or world symbol, of course, is both a pleasure and a peril. Douglas's extended family become the Black First family, and they're constantly in the press.
Fame was such a double-edged sword for Douglas because on the one hand, it's personally fulfilling and very lucrative. But on the other hand, it's exhausting and it's alienating. He had some internal struggles with relevancy and how he will maintain his status as a man of consequence after the Civil War.
A battlefield of soldiers.
When the war for the Union was substantially ended and peace had dawned upon the land, when the gigantic system of American slavery was finally abolished, a strange, perhaps perverse feeling came over me. My great and exceeding joy over these stupendous achievements was slightly tinged with a feeling of sadness. The anti-slavery platform had performed its work, and my voice was no longer needed.
He thought, well, who will want to hear from me anymore? Slavery's ended. What is his personal role now?
But all he had to do, someone could go back in time and say, Fred, don't despair. You know, hang around. White supremacy's just asleep. And it's not going to be asleep for very long.
The Emancipation Proclamation had given slavery many deadly wounds, yet it was in fact only wounded and crippled, not disabled and killed.
A photo of Black people working a field.
Though slavery was abolished, the wrongs of my people were not ended.
Black girls behind an iron fence.
Though they were not slaves, they were not yet quite free. I therefore soon found that the Negro had still a cause, and that he needed my voice and my pen to plead for it.
It is Reconstruction and its decline and defeat that now causes Douglas to find a new voice, a new role, if he can.
Words appear on a black background. Part 5, Lessons of the Hour. Text fades in over an American flag. Reconstruction lasted for 12 years after the Civil War, and it transformed the United States Constitution. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The 14th Amendment granted birthright citizenship to all Americans. The 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote.
Reconstruction is arguably the most hopeful period of Douglas's life. It is a legal, constitutional, political revolution, and a new United States is being made out of that. There's a time there when he holds these two appointive positions in Washington, and he's part of the federal bureaucracy.
He wanted to have enough money to take care of his family. He wanted to be respected. He wanted to get government jobs that affirmed his own idea of his importance.
Douglas is a classic example of an old radical outsider who becomes, with time, a political insider. There are many now next-generation black leaders who are now his rivals.
He's frequently referred to as the old man, particularly by young Turks out to slay him, out to take his position.
They're all 20 years younger, at least. They're all college-educated, free-born, and he gets into very public disputes with them in the press.
I need not tell you, Mr. Editor, that no man is safe these days from the attacks of anonymous falsifiers. If my record of more than 40 years of service to the colored race does not protect me from vile insinuations, nothing I can now say will silence them.
He was a very hypersensitive man as he got older. He liked being on a pedestal. He didn't like being knocked off.
He now has white hair.
When Anna died in 82, after long illness, Douglas came apart. I think he had another, at least temporary, breakdown.
A portrait shows Anna Douglas staring off with a somber gaze.
But within about 15 months, he married Helen Pitts. She was a white woman, and she's 20 years younger, and it became the most scandalous marriage of the 19th century.
Together in a portrait.
The uproar from the black community and the white community is enormous.
For months it was in the press. But they basically just consistently said, we'll marry whom we wish.
I have had very little sympathy with the curiosity of the world about my domestic relations. What business has the world with the color of my wife?
So imagine that you're Frederick Douglass, and what you really want to do is read novels and travel around the world.
And yet, once in a while, there's an issue that just brings him back to the fore.
Headlines read, Negroes lynched, hanged, exhumed, burned, and hunted.
Black men in the former Confederate states get the right to vote 2 years after the end of the Civil War. And that right is greeted with terrorism, threats, repression, violence, rape, lynching.
Reconstruction is full of mob actions, mob violence, massacres of people. It's just the destruction of life out of fear and the feeling of the threat to the social and political order as white people wished it.
Soon Reconstruction is over, and we see the formalization of Jim Crow white supremacy.
A photo of a white man resting his feet on a black man's shoulders.
So it's in the early 1890s that he has to speak out more. He writes his final speech in 1893. Then he begins to take it on the road. He's also growing old. He's not well. He is constantly complaining about his hands shaking. He's complaining about chest pains. He's complaining about incredible weariness.
But he's always drawn back into combat. The war is never over because white supremacy is the beast that won't be defeated.
Text appears on a black background. Lessons of the Hour, 1894, performed by Jeffrey Wright with a graying beard and shaved head. Jeffrey ambles to the center of the warehouse.
Friends and fellow citizens, strange things have happened of late and are still happening. Some of these tend to dim the luster of the American name and chill the hopes we once entertained for the cause of American liberty. Principles which we all thought to have been permanently settled by the late war have been boldly assaulted and overthrown by the defeated party. When the moral sense of a nation begins to decline and the wheel of progress to roll backward, there's no telling how low one will fall or where the other may stop. I have waited patiently but anxiously to see the end of the epidemic of mob law and persecution now prevailing in the South. Our newspapers are daily disfigured by its ghastly horrors. It's commonly thought that only the lowest and most disgusting birds and beasts, such as buzzards, vultures, and hyenas, will gloat over and prey upon dead bodies. But the Southern mob, in its rage, feeds its vengeance by shooting, stabbing, and burning when their victims are dead. Their institutions have taught them no respect for human life, and especially the life of the Negro.
Jeffrey levels a harsh gaze.
But my friends, I must stop. Time and strength are not equal to the task before me.
Jeffrey arches his brow.
But could I be heard by this great nation? I would call to mind the sublime and glorious truths with which at its birth it saluted a listening world. It announced the advent of a nation based upon human brotherhood and the self-evident truths of liberty and equality. Apply these sublime and glorious truths to the situation now before you. Put away your prejudice. Banish the idea that one class must rule over another. Recognize the fact that the rights of the humblest citizen are as worthy of protection as are those of the highest, and your problem will be solved. And whatever may be in store for it in the future, whether prosperity or adversity, whether it shall have foes without or foes within, whether there shall be peace or war, based on the eternal principles of truth, justice, and humanity, your republic will stand and flourish forever.
A hand-drawn portrait of Douglass is on the cover of his last speech.
This Lessons of the Hour is a speech that resonates now because in some ways we're revisiting a similar cycle. He represents what we miss and how we are weakened as a society if we are making it our institutional business to suppress certain voices, talents, certain minds, certain bodies. How can we as a people not know of a man like Frederick Douglass? All of us, whether we be black, white, or otherwise, or immigrant, or 10 generations here, He's an exemplar American.
This is a man who lives essentially the whole trajectory of 19th century America, slavery to freedom, to the betrayal of that freedom, but still trying to hang on to some kind of philosophical and principled hope.
There's still hope, but we still have to fight.
A photo of Douglas as an older man.
We all tend to romanticize the way that Douglas bounced back and the way he refused to be daunted. I find it enormously depressing that he had to bounce back. You see the Civil War won, you see the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and still on the eve of your death, having to give a speech saying, if I have to leave this world behind, with three words echoing in your ears, those words are hope, faith, and charity? No. We will overcome? No. Agitate.
Andre continues reading from the autobiographies.
I have now brought my readers to the end of my story. I have written out my experiences here, not in order to exhibit my wounds and bruises and to awaken and attract sympathy to myself personally, but as a part of the history of a profoundly interesting period in American life and progress.
A dandelion seed.
My part has been to tell the story of the slave. The story of the master never wanted for narrators. 40 years of my life have been given to the cause of my people, and if I had 40 years more, they should all be sacredly given to the same great cause.
The photo, our scouts and guides.
Taking all the circumstances into consideration, the colored people have no reason to despair. Notwithstanding the great and all-abounding darkness of our social past, notwithstanding the clouds that still overhang us in the moral and social sky, it is my faith that a better and brighter day will yet come.
Andre gingerly closes the book of Douglas's autobiographies, then levels a resolute gaze at us. Cut to black. Credits roll as various works of art portray Frederick Douglass. Executive producers, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Dylan McGee. Cast, Nicole Beharie, Coleman Domingo, Jonathan Majors, Denzel Whitaker, Jeffrey Wright. Narration by Andre Holland. Historical consultant, David Blight. Credits continue. Copyright 2022, Home Box Office Incorporated. All rights reserved. First publication of this motion picture, sound recording, and film, United States of America 2022. Home Box Office Incorporated is the owner of the copyright in this motion picture. This motion picture is protected by the copyright laws of the United States of America and other countries. Any unauthorized duplication, copying, or use of all or part of this motion picture may result in civil liability and/or criminal prosecution in accordance with applicable laws. A presentation of Home Box Office. Audio description created by Point 360, written by Court Soto, and narrated by Bill Larson.